Here's some quotes. I am concerned for the security of our great nation, not so much because of any threat from without, but because of the insidious forces working from within. That's General Douglas MacArthur. The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise their power from behind the scenes. Justice Felix Frankfurter, U.S. Supreme Court. We know in the not-too-distant future a half-dozen corporations are going to control the media. We took this step, this merger, to ensure that we were one of them. That's a Time Warner spokesperson. How about this one? For more than a century, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidents such as an encounter with Castro to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. David Rockefeller, from his own book, Memoirs. The military is an integral part of force projection, isn't it? We're with Douglas Dietrich tonight, and we will be back to discuss just how far down the road it is, and always has been, and may yet be. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. John B. Wells in with you tonight. Delighted to be with you, and thank you very much for spending some of your most precious resource with us, and that is your time, and we hope you will enjoy tonight's program. It is not unusual for large amounts of documentation and all sorts of other artifacts to be done away with. I can think of one instance that has nothing to do with tonight's guest's initiative. That would be Mr. Douglas Dietrich. This concerned a huge, huge radio station that I was privileged to be the voice of for about 10 years. I can't tell you where it is, but the initials are NYC. And somebody decided that, not the station, the city. Somebody decided that it was just too much expense to continue to pay for those archives. So all of these historical recordings from names you would recognize instantly, covering all of these events going back decades that you would recognize instantly, are now gone. So, Douglas, tell us about some of these documents and take us as far back, all the way back to World War II, if you like. Take us as far back and bring us to the front and just, I just urge you to meter your speeches because you have a lot to bring to the party and I want everybody to get the favors, okay?
Yes, sir, and really appreciate your giving me the opportunity. I'm going to try and breathe while I talk.
Well, and I'm going to try not to to just interrupt you gratuitously. The only time that I'll do that is if we start butting up against a hard break and just have to do it. So when you hear the music come up, just find a stopping point because I don't want to cut you off. I got a feeling no matter where I cut you off, it's going to be at a critical point. So let her rip, man.
You bet, and I'll count on you for adult supervision to guide us in the right direction whenever you feel we're just getting too obtuse.
Okay, well, now we're really in trouble, so go ahead.
Well, what you mentioned about those hidden powers and principalities, so to speak, behind the Washington scenes, I think that's most manifested in what got us into the war in China and what ultimately lost China, as a lot of the older Americans remember it, because a lot of Americans remember my father's time with involvement in China before the Second World War, and a lot of them remember Taiwan, where I was born, and a lot of them wonder, how did it all happen like that? Why did it wind up that way? And so what had really happened was, for extremely strange reasons, Roosevelt seemed very much intent on propagating the ideology of communism in China. And that is most evident in Lachlan Currie, and his last name was spelled C-U-R-R-I-E, first name Lachlan, L-A-U-C-H-L-I-N. And in July of 1939, FDR named this Canadian citizen, which is exactly what he was. He had never applied for, nor in his entire lifetime would he ever be awarded U.S. citizenship, but he was made the White House economist to advise on taxation, Social Security, U.S. Treasury affairs, and most tellingly, the speeding up of wartime production. And the end result was that he wound up being exposed by the FBI as a member of the Silver Master spy ring. And that was because they were intercepting transmissions to the forerunner of the KGB, which back in those days was known as NKVD. And when they exposed this to Roosevelt, apparently he had the feeling, well, if this guy's got so many communist connections, let's send him to China to talk with Mao Zedong, who was at that time a revolutionary in the mainland fighting Chiang Kai-shek, who later on established the nationalist government on Taiwan, into which I was born. But Lachlan Currie went over there to China, and what he set up was Chennault's Flying Tigers. And this is how our bureaucracy, of which I speak, and our politicians turn soldiers into criminals, because the Flying Tigers were a mercenary wing of Americans, and they were criminals as defined under sections 956 through 960 of the United States Criminal Code, which legally restricts all collusive aggressive activity and forbids conspiracies to injure the property of any foreign state, the hiring or retaining of persons within the United States, whence all of the American volunteer group, also known as the Flying Tigers, source from, for enlistment in any foreign military service, and the furnishing of money for any military enterprise against the territory of any foreign state. Well, all this got set up by Lachlan Currie, and a lot of people remember they were flying nationalist Chinese symbols. But at the same time, a lot of people don't realize that they had a bomber wing. And people can look this up and they can confirm what I'm saying. The Flying Tigers bomber wing was usually sent in support of communist operations. And to finalize what I'm saying in regards to that, there was Brigadier General Evans Fortis Carlson of Carlson's Raiders, the Marine Corps Raiders, which would later on gain international fame. And he became an ardent communist. And he said that the Marines should, like the Maoists, have only leaders and fighters instead of enlisted men and officers.
So this is after this was after Chiang Kai-shek was out.
No, this was like before. This was why Chiang Kai-shek ultimately came to not trust the United States. And this was how America ultimately lost China. They were continually betraying Chiang Kai-shek and cooperating with the communists. Indeed, it was Brigadier General Evans Fortis Carlson who was responsible, in a sense, for the Nanjing massacre, because what had happened was the Chinese were negotiating a peace with Chiang Kai-shek. And if a peace had been negotiated at that time between Japan and China, that would have given Japan an enormous sway over Asia. America definitely needed that power base in Asia, so they wanted to break that up, that peace agreement. So it was Carlson's raiders that attacked the Japanese headquarters while they were negotiating peace with the Chinese, and the Japanese responded not only with the Nanjing massacre, but by sinking the Pan Am and the British Ladybird, because they found out later on that English-speaking whites had been seen in coolie uniforms that had massacred their officers. And so this was a tremendous atrocity that was triggered for political purposes. And again, there's no exaggerating this. Evans Carlson of the United States Marine Corps was a avowed communist and quite vocal about it, and wrote several papers recommending that the U.S. Marines follow the communist example. As a matter of fact, that's why the Raiders didn't survive World War II. After World War II, you never saw a Raider unit again. And they were completely dismantled as a unit of the Marine Corps because they were felt to have been so thoroughly communized by Truman. So that's the kind of strangeness we're talking about in our history. And it ultimately wound up with the Japanese winning in China in the same sense that the Germans won in World War One against the Russians. A lot of people don't realize that. But in World War One, fighting a two-front war, the Kaiser's troops defeated Tsarist Russia. They wound up gaining almost one-third of the Russian population and one-third of its really arable land that was west of Moscow in the Brest-Litovsk Agreement. And the only reason that that got lost to them later was because of the consequent flu pandemic, which killed 100 million people in Europe. It edged out the Black Plague in terms of deaths per population, and they pretty much lost their ability to retain their holdings. And that's what ended World War One. A lot of people say, World War One ended because of some Allied victory, but the truth is it ended because of the plague. Germany was never invaded. And as a direct result, Emperor Hirohito, who was a marine biologist and the only scientist ever to become a head of state in the history of all mankind, until Angela Merkel was elected the Prime Minister of United Germany, literally a few years ago. She herself is a scientist. I believe she's a chemist. But at any rate, she is the first scientist to ever serve as a head of state since the time of Emperor Hirohito. Well, he was a marine biologist, and he noticed how World War I was ended by a plague. He also noticed that a lot of American writing talked about using plagues against Asian populations. A lot of this was done by Jack London. Jack London, in 1910, wrote a short story called The Unparalleled Invasion, in which he recommended that all of the European and American nations get together and exterminate the entire Asian population of planet Earth using plague and bacterial weapons. And as a result, Emperor Hirohito felt that the Asian peoples were tremendously threatened by this mindset. He became an expert in biological warfare and learned how to apply it ruthlessly. And so that certainly is something that I can follow up with and get into. But definitely, I do count on you to guide us through this, because I'm sure there's plenty of questions that come up in terms of the war itself that you might ask based on what you know of the World War II technology. I understand that you yourself are very much an expert in the aerodynamics of that day and age. And you could help me along in terms of guiding this conversation towards something that the audience can appreciate.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. Now, I'm not an expert at it. I'm a dabbler. And I think somebody quoted me as saying, if it's not a quote, it should have been. I know a little about a lot of things, but I don't know much about most things. Mm-hmm. As far as the aircraft is concerned, I can tell you that most of the stuff that's flying today that we think of as our design goes back to the 30s. Most people don't know Frank Whittle in England invented the jet engine. He's 37 or 39, and Ernst Haeckel was a month after him.
Right.
Our F-86 Sabre jet that was flown against the MiG. The MiG was Kurt Tank's design of Focke Wulf.
Yes.
And the F-86 was Willie Messerschmitt's design.
Yes. Yes.
Unbelievable. So, but here's the thing. It's our understanding. Okay, well, the Japanese are on an imperialistic march. They want to take over the world. They're getting it on with the Chinese. They're getting it on with the Russians. Roosevelt somehow knew that the war was coming and made sure to send them plenty of scrap iron so they could build a war machine. In the meantime, they stole Howard Hughes's H-1 design, turned it into the Japanese Zero. Then, in their quest for power, they attacked Pearl Harbor, and we went over there and beat them up, and they were so tenacious we had to use nuclear weapons on them, and then they quit. But somehow or another, Hirohito remained on his throne, and a lot of the people that had done worse things than Mengele did for Germany, those people were able to beat the rap and walk because they agreed to turn over their medical research. And yes, that's about the end of it. End of the war, a couple of bombs, we're all good. Now they're starving. Ramen noodles come along. The man who invented them, he just passed away recently. He's feeding them because they're starving. And MacArthur said, send me bullets or send me some food, one of the two. And that's about all we know about it.
Right, right. And that, of course, is the great tragedy of the Pacific Theater, is that comparatively speaking, with volumes and volumes written on European history, there's almost nothing that's known about Asia. So in terms of trying to present it to the American public as a service to why our strategy has been so fouled up ever since, it's because we're operating on a basis of false reality. And if someone continually acts on foundations of sand, all of their actions are going to come to naught. And we have to ask ourselves, if World War II was such a bang-up victory, why is it that Korea turned into such a stalemate? Why is it that Vietnam turned into what could be argued as a series of military victories for the United States on the ground, and yet something that was ultimately lost politically? And we come to Iraq and Afghanistan and the quagmires we have there. There's no denying that the world is far different than what we've come to understand. Everybody looks on World War II as this good war and this fairy tale war with a big bang ending. And I think it's about time that our population realizes that we have to Vietnamize World War II, in a sense, by showing the fact that it wasn't a big bang ending, that it went on for years, that per Title 38 of the U.S. Code, which is law as established by Congress, it is recognized that World War II, for United States proactive participation, did not end until December 31st of 1946, not 1945. And people can vet this. Also, Any veterans' claims, any veterans surviving from World War II, trying to establish service-connected disability per Code 2, which equals World War II by the Veterans Administration's computer classification, they have to go through the Code of Federal Regulations. And they implement the laws pursuant to the U.S. Code and thereby also extend in recognition to establish service connection. The end of World War II is December 31st, 1946. And the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, holds equal status with the law equivalent to executive orders. So your own government, the United States government, says the war did not end in 1945. And if we realize that World War II was a United Nations war, one of the reasons that I worked at the Presidio Military Base destroying so many documents was because they had so many to destroy from an organization that was no longer on site, and that was the United Nations. The United Nations was founded at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco in January 1st of 1942, just 3 weeks and 3 days after Pearl Harbor, and it was established as an organization of war per Title 42 of the United Nations Charter. They have a charter in lieu of a constitution. And as an organization of war, the United Nations orchestrated all of the resistance armies within Axis-occupied nations, from Denmark to the Philippines, all through the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco.
Now, is everybody getting this? Because this is extraordinary.
Yeah. And the United Nations itself had a battle flag, which people can look up. If they look up on the web, they can, or through a search engine, they can find the United Nations battle flag. And it's a very simple flag, a white field with four red stripes going down vertically next to each other, which represented Roosevelt's four freedoms. And this was so resistance armies could identify each other in the field very easily. And so there were literally hundreds of pounds of resistance army documents sent to the United Nations that I was ordered to incinerate. One of the reasons why all of this was backed up was because the incinerators were literally crematoria, and they were not used for bodies, but they could have been, because all of these old locker boxes were heavy wood. They had metal lining, and a lot of them had metal corners, and so it was like putting coffins inside of an incinerator. So if you literally stuck a coffin with a body in there, those incinerators would have worked. They were based on the same principle. And what happened was some librarian came in, pig-faced drunk, 10 years before I worked there. He was saturated in alcohol. He fell into the incinerator and got burned up enough to the point where he died. After that, nobody would touch them. I came in as a librarian's aide. They gave me the dirtiest, most dangerous work. And they said, we have 10 years of backed up documents, and you got to start destroying them. And they went all the way back to the Spanish-American War. And so I was taking copious notes because so much of history was being destroyed. But in terms of what we're talking about with the end of the war, the United Nations recognized the war between Japan and America as ending September 8, 1951, when the Japanese-American Peace Treaty was signed by Prime Minister Shigeru Yoshida and the United States government in the presence of 52 nations of the United Nations on site, the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco. Now, I have a few photos that I've included in my DVDs, which I've stolen from the State Department and the when it was involved with the United Nations at the time and its records that it left at the Presidio Military Base, showing this ceremony, which no Americans ever heard of. And so this legally ended the war. But until that period of time, there were still Japanese prisoners of war in the United States.
Unbelievable.
And
it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right, now hold your thoughts, because I know you got a bunch of them. And I want to mention to you that our friend Fred has said, when one links to your website, DouglasDietrich.com, he spelled it correctly, DouglasDietrich.com, unless you go to the cached parts, you cannot reach the website. He wants to know, is some department of the U.S. government taking the site down? I don't think so, but you never know.
Oh, gosh, I hope not. Hopefully they can handle it on the bandwidth through whatever site my agent's working with. That's all technical stuff. It's way beyond my capability of understanding.
Hopefully. You might want to check on that while we take this little break. And then, everyone, please keep in mind that history is generally regarded as what's behind us. But the history that's in front of us to become history at some point, if that makes any sense whatsoever, is a little bit like pulling a bed sheet. You pull the corner, and the whole thing moves. So stand by, because more enlightenment is on the way from the bridge of the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Douglas Dietrich tonight. All of the things that we've seen All of the things that we've read are not necessarily the way things were. And let us keep in mind that these causes are always smaller than their effects. And these causes, under discussion tonight, are not small, and their effects are enormous and long-lasting. We're talking with Mr. Dietrich tonight about things that happened decades and decades and decades ago. And yet, here we are in 2011, and their effects are being felt, and the initiatives set up so long ago are now being played out. The question is, do we have the knowledge, the intuition, to alter the course that we are seemingly, maybe even inexorably pursuing? We'll get into that and lots more when we come back, and we will, to Coast AM. All right, Douglas, talk to us tonight. You know, their heads are exploding out there. John, can't understand what Douglas is saying. Please slow him down.
Oh, gosh, I'm trying to breathe while I talk. I was hoping I was succeeding, so I'll...
I can't hear you breathe. That's a compliment, actually. You used to have training for that, you know, so... And now, of course, they can just edit it out.
Right. You're too kind. Yeah, that's... Well, guys like you and me, we're lucky if we can get a breath when we wake up in the morning.
when we were talking on the phone, that's for sure. And in fact, the more they spray that stuff to make these art, and that's a topic for another time. But the more they spray this stuff up into the atmosphere, the more difficult it is to get a breath in the morning. And it's getting increasingly difficult to do it after you're awake and been up for a while.
It's so true. You were saying, sir, about...
Well, how long did that war last for some people?
Well, if you ask an average American, how long did World War II last? They're going to say from 1941 to 1945, which is about 4 years and a few months, so about 4.5 years. And if you ask a European or a Britisher, how long did World War II last? They're going to say 9 years, from 1939 to 1945. If you ask a Japanese person, how long did World War II last? They're going to say 15 years, because they invaded Manchuria in 1931, reestablished the Manchurian Imperium under Emperor Puyi, and continued fighting, as far as they know, up until 1945, when there was a ceasefire. And if you ask any Japanese person who lives in Brazil, as odd as this sounds, the largest Japanese population in the world outside of Japan has, for almost 100 years now, or a little over 100 years by now, been Brazil. And they're mostly concentrated in Sao Paulo. And if you ask them, how long did World War II last? The vast majority of the older generation will say 20 years, because they'll count it from the invasion of Manchuria up until the date of the United Nations signing that peace treaty with Japan, between Japan and the United States, in September 8th of 1951. The reason why was because Japanese submarines, which were prowling the east coast of the United States, threatening the United States with nuclear attack, would port for vacation and leave in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And there were two factors that made this possible for the Japanese to strategically threaten the United States all the way up until 1951, when the United States desperately needed Japan as an ally in the Second Korean War. The first one, Korean War, being the American invasion of Korea shortly after the American Civil War, in which they installed an American dictator named Durham White Stevens over the Korean Peninsula back in the 1860s, late 1860s, early 1870s. And that man was later assassinated in San Francisco in front of the Ferry Building, and I dealt with the police records, and he was assassinated by two Korean assassins, and both of them went home alive. And he was written about in the New York Times. His obituary said that Durham White Stevens was the American dictator of Korea. He was known internationally as a Caucasian who had been placed in charge of the Korean Peninsula. That was America's first Korean War. If you ask any American about it, there's very few Americans, including professors of history, who even know about it. But if they look it up on a search engine, they'll vet everything I'm saying and find out it's true.
So can you clear up a little bit of this China, Japan, and Korea
triangle? I'm going to try because it's so important. Basically, what happened was, just as America had occupied South Vietnam while waging a war against North Vietnam, here they are occupying a nation while fighting a war. Just as they occupied South Korea while fighting against the North, here they are occupying a nation while fighting a war. The same thing happened with Japan. You had an occupation of the Japanese home islands, but before 1945, over 90% of the Imperial Japanese Army, which was the largest employer of anyone in the nation of Japan, more Japanese worked for the Imperial Japanese Army than any other part of Japanese society, over 90% of that army was in China. And that was on the day of the Hiroshima bombing. And on the day of the Hiroshima bombing, George Catlett Marshall, who essentially was running the United States war effort with Admiral King, received a report saying that on the day of the Hiroshima bombing, the Japanese had just raised 40 more divisions. And he was told at that point that all of this massive mobilization had just occurred. Japan had just begun to fight, which is why so few able-bodied Japanese men had ever died in any of these conventional fire bombings or atomic bombings. And the war was just beginning. And basically, a lot of these people in high command of the U.S. military welcomed it, because at this point, they had never had such control over the U.S. population in the entire history of the United States. At this point, the U.S. was on a war footing. The U.S. military had 27 million men in uniform. If you count the people overseas, if you count the people on radar watching Greenland, if you count the people in uniforms at home, the entire United States was militarized. Truman, they considered to be a joke because they didn't know about his personality. Truman had been vice president for 28 days before he became president. He had just gotten to the office because Roosevelt had gotten rid of the man before him, who again had been found to be a card-carrying communist. And with Truman ushered in, he had never met Roosevelt. He had only posed twice with him in photo ops. He had no knowledge of the war. He had no knowledge of anything that was going on that the military was doing. So the military thought, hey, from now on, we're running the show. We've got a draft. We can just keep sending these men into the Pacific. And the longer this lasts for us, the better. We never want it to end. And it never did end for them. After Japan, there was Korea, there was Vietnam. The draft continued through that entire period of time. And these men had a huge amount of power in the United States that they never should have had. As a result, a lot of men needlessly died. And one of this was due to this kind of criminal kind of corruption, where they just fed off this war effort. And that's one way that World War II was Vietnamized. Another way was they didn't know how prepared the Japanese had been. For instance, the Imperial Japanese Army, and again, people can vet this, was in possession in 1945 of no less than 7 carriers. And everyone knows, oh, the Japanese lost their carrier fleet. Oh, at Midway, everything was destroyed at that point in terms of any naval efforts. Well, the Japanese Army had never even deployed its carriers yet. Now, granted, these were escort carriers made to carry about 35 planes each, but these 7 could serve as strike carriers, either with bombers or with the new jets the Japanese had gotten as knockoffs from the Germans, and could strike out of China at any time. And that was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the weapons that the Japanese were amassing. Biological, the submarines, the Sentoku submarines that I mentioned, they're known as the I-400. People can look them up, S-E-N-T-O-K-U. And the Sentoku submarines were the largest submarines that had ever been built prior to the advent of the nuclear submarine. They were 400 feet long. Each one of them was made to carry 3 scout planes or 2 Peggy bombers, known as the Huryu, or flying dragon type of medium bomber. Now, the Huryu was built to carry an atomic bomb, and it was built around the bomb. And what that was a uranium little boy styled bomb, which was elongated to fit within a medium bomber. The plane was built around it. And beyond that, what people don't understand is the Japanese had atomic bombs. They had plenty of them. And the reason why was because of Konan Complex and Birobidzhan, the Jewish settlement in Manchuria. When Adolf Hitler started to purge Europe of Jews, Hirohito felt a tremendous obligation to help many Jews resettle in Asia, because the Sassoon, known as the J.P. Morgan of Asia, ran the Shanghai Stock Exchange. He had lost family members to Russian pogroms. And during the Russo-Japanese War, he had financed the Japanese war machine to victory in 1904 and 1905. So in return, because Sephardim Jewish immigrants ran about one-third of the Shanghai Stock Exchange, they were able to help many Jewish emigres escape from the Third Reich and resettle in Asia. They were resettled in a buffer state between Manchuria and the Soviet Union that is still there today. And people can look this up on the search engines by looking up the Jewish Autonomous Oblast. And it's a Yiddish-speaking nation. It is not recognized by the United Nations. It has a tourist board. People can visit there. At the same time, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because it was occupied at the end of World War II, many of the people who lived there took advantage of the Soviet Union's collapse to move to Israel. But during its heyday, when it was run in as an ally of the Japanese, there were 1 million resettled Jews in Birobidzhan. These were CPAs, MDs, engineers, physicists, and mathematicians of great brilliance. And they helped the Japanese to build the bomb. Now, where'd they get the supplies? Konan Complex in North Korea. All of the atomic bombs that North Korea threatens world peace with today are built in Japanese nuclear bomb manufacturing plants that were set up by the Japanese in World War II. The North Koreans called it Hongnam, H-U-N-G-N-A-M. People can look that up. In Japan's day, when Korea was part of Japan, it was called Konan, K-O-N-A-N. And Konan Complex had dammed 3 rivers, Yalu, Chosen, and another river whose name I forget, but people can find it on the map in that region. They were all dammed and provided the Konan Complex with literally enough energy so that it rivaled the entire nation of Japan. It put out as much energy as one-third of the nation of Japan on any given day. And it was never bombed throughout the war. The Americans were never able to reach it, and it was surrounded by uranium ore deposits. Now, as soon as Einstein had come up with the equations for E equals MC squared, the Japanese jumped on the nuclear bomb manufacturing idea, and they had purchased cyclotrons in San Francisco during the San Francisco World's Fair, which they purchased from, which were on display, put on display at the San Francisco World's Fair by UC Berkeley at the time. The Japanese actually purchased it, brought it back to Japan. They had more than a few cyclotrons in Japan. And a cyclotron, of course, doesn't make a bomb, but they had Konan Complex, which was an industrial site, the largest in Asia, which did. And the end result was they deployed them to stop the Soviet advance. And when the Soviets invaded at the end of the war and they invaded Manchuria, the Japanese had to stop them because Korea and Japan are so close that if you drink a can of beer on a Japanese beach and you throw it in the water, it'll float up on a Korean beach. They're so close that they could build a bridge. Politics is the only thing that prevented it. And during the war, the Japanese never built a bridge or a tunnel because they didn't want an invading power like the Soviets to be able to use that to their own military advantage. Now, when the Soviets were plowing down through the Korean Peninsula after taking Manchuria and the Jewish buffer state of Birobidzhan, then the Japanese stopped them with Genzai Bakuton, the Japanese atomic bomb, which was blown after Nagasaki. And the Americans wrote about it in several papers that I was ordered to destroy. But it leaked to the American press probably around 1947. And let me see if I can look up my my notes here. Basically, I'll find the paper that it was released in, give it to the audience in just a minute. But what I do want to say is that here we are. The Atlanta Constitution in the summer of 1946 wrote an article on the Japanese atomic bomb blowing and stopping the Soviets cold. Also referenced Japan's Secret War by Robert B. Wilcox.
Wait. You're killing me.
I'm sorry.
Doug. Douglas, I'm sorry. Are you... A nuclear weapon was used?
That is correct. And as a matter of fact, he created a blast crater because what they did was they put several nuclear weapons together. They blew them on August 12th. This was after the explosion at Nagasaki. And that's why the Korean Demilitarized Zone was created. I mean, any American will tell you the Japanese were trying to expedite getting the Americans on the Korean Peninsula as soon as possible after the ceasefire. But the Americans were not there to stop the Soviets. Nothing was going to stop the Soviets. What stopped them was the operational deployment of a Japanese atomic bomb. And astronauts will still verify to this day that there are only 2 man-made objects that are visible with the naked eye from the moon. One of them is the Great Wall of China, and the other is the Korean Demilitarized Zone. I mean, the blast created was several miles of no man's land, which today, because it's all barbed wired off and mined, serves as one of the greatest nature reserves in the world. There are tigers and cranes and other animals that would be extinct if it were not for that blast site. Even though it was radiated for a short time, the radiation quickly dissipated because the bombs of those days were not the kind of bombs we started tossing around later. They were comparatively clean explosions. That is a fact of that war, which ultimately led to the Korean War as we understood it. That's one of the reasons why the Americans had to call on the Japanese as an ally, because since those were Japanese waters in the old days, the Japanese captains were asked to help the Americans as minesweeper in minesweeper operations. So as a result, the Americans had to sign a security relations pact with Japan the same time that the peace treaty was signed in 1951. And to emphasize the kind of strangeness of that war, Korean War being a United Nations war, any bodies that they find from the Korean War today that are brought back to the United States, they're covered in United Nations flags. They are not brought home under American flags because the Korean War was a United Nations war. And what people have to understand is that World War II was a United Nations war. And a lot of casualties, a lot of fatalities get hidden by counting them as United Nations casualties or fatalities, as opposed to American casualties or fatalities. That's a record-keeping trick very few people are aware of. But as part of the kind of information within information that I'm trying to make the public realize made this war a lot uglier, a lot longer. The Chinese Civil War continued until 1949, when the Chinese government moved on to Taiwan. Now, Taiwan was an integral part of Japan since 1895, and nobody ever says, hey, wait a second, I don't remember the Americans invading Taiwan like they did Iwo Jima. I don't remember anyone invading Taiwan. So how did the Chinese wind up on a Japanese island? And the end result was Chiang Kai-shek had brokered a separate peace with Japan. That's how the Japanese army was able to stay in China in large amounts until 1949. And that's where the Sentoku submarines were based. That's where they could take off, they could port in the southern Philippines in Mindanao, where there was the largest Japanese, one of the largest Japanese population cities in the world was in Davao, D-A-V-A-O, in Mindanao, the southern Islamic-dominated Philippines. And the Filipino Muslims hated the United States because during the Spanish-American War and the consequent Filipino insurgency, the Americans were used what they called the Filipino Scouts. These were American Marines and American soldiers who were given higher rates of pay and higher rates of promotion if they participated in genocidal actions against the Muslims who would not surrender to the American occupation. By the end of the Filipino insurrection, over 3 million Muslim Filipinos had been killed. And Terry Nichols, who participated in the Oklahoma City bombing, he was married to a Filipina Muslim, and that was one of the reasons why he became a convert and hated the United States so much, because he found out about this history. He's always dying to talk about it, but they keep him buried in a concrete hole. Another man who married a Filipina Muslim and became an America hater was Bobby Fischer. And he made a lot of comments against America once he found out this bit of history. But a lot of Filipinos know about it, but the Catholic North and the Muslim South have been at war forever. So even though the Americans retook the Philippines, it was an occupation where they didn't really hold the Philippines in the South. The Japanese were able to port there. They were able to port at Sao Paulo in Brazil. They were able to threaten the Americans with nuclear attack with the atomic bombs that they had produced by the dozens, launched by medium-sized Huryu, medium bombers, that were catapulted out of the Sentoku submarines. Anyone who looks up the Sentoku submarine will find that these were airplane-launching submarines. There were 17 of them that were manufactured. The Emperor Hirohito surrendered two of them to the United States. Another one was sunk off of Gotu Island in 1947.
All right, hold it right there, man. We got to come back. We've got to come back. And then when we do come back, I want to discuss with you why none of this stuff has made it into anybody's high school education. Our friend Hugh pointed that out. He's not sure that this is on the level. And when we come back, we'll get some bona fides going and explore the question if the best creditee is the one who never pays his debt off, is the best war the one that never ends. What do you think? This is the Mothership, Coast to Coast AM.